From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. Today, satirist and novelist Gary Steingart talks about his memoir, Little Failure. Steingart was a sickly, asthmatic 7-year-old when his family emigrated to the U.S. from the Soviet Union.
And by the way, anyone who wants to be a writer out there, the first thing you have to have growing up is asthma.
Steingart's family had been prevented from practicing Judaism in Russia, and so little Gary was sent to a Hebrew school in Queens, which he hated. And he was circumcised at age 8. The country that he was taught was his enemy was now his home.
My father took me aside and said, look, everything you believed in, everything you loved was a lie. And now you have to forget Lenin, and now you have to love Ronald Reagan.
Also, David Edelstein reviews the new film Whiplash, and as TV critic, I review Showtime's The Affair, which could be the best new show of 2014. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. After drawing on his life in his satirical novels, like The Russian Debutante's Handbook, Absurdistan, and Super Sad True Love Story, today's guest, Gary Steingart, wrote a memoir called Little Failure. It's now out in paperback. As Andy Borowitz wrote in his New York Times review, the book is both hilarious and moving. Steingart was a wheezing, asthmatic, and fearful 7-year-old when he and his parents emigrated from the Soviet Union to Queens, New York in 1979. This was soon after America negotiated a trade deal with the Soviets that included allowing Jews to emigrate to Israel, Canada, or the U.S. Suddenly, little Gary was living in the country he had been taught was the enemy. His parents, who had been prevented from practicing Judaism in the Soviet Union, sent Gary to a Hebrew school in Queens, where he felt lost and despised. And as he slowly became more American, the distance between him and his parents seemed to grow. As he got older, girls, booze, and eventually 12 years of 4 times a week psychoanalysis entered the picture. Throughout, writing was a constant, dating back to when he was 5 and wrote a comic novel that was 100 pages long. Terry Gross spoke to Gary Steingart last January.
Welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You know, part of your book is about when you were growing up, you had such severe asthma. And that was part of the reason your family left Russia. And I'd like to start by having you read a paragraph from the beginning of your memoir. And it has to do with one of the reasons why your family left.
Yes. And by the way, anyone who wants to be a writer out there, the first thing you have to have growing up is asthma. So I recommend growing up in a place like Leningrad, which was built over a swamp, which will be very conducive to your not breathing. So here is what happened, and one of the main reasons we did leave Russia. Unbeknownst to me, my mother was in the middle of a crisis herself, wondering whether to stay behind with my sick grandmother in Russia or leave her behind forever and emigrate to America. The decision was made for her in a greasy Crimean cafeteria. Over a bowl of tomato soup, a stout Siberian woman told my mother of the senseless beating her 18-year-old son had endured after his conscription by the Red Army, a beating that had cost him a kidney. The woman took out a photo of her boy. He resembled a moose of great stature crossbred with an equally colossal ox. My mother took one look at the fallen giant and then at her tiny, wheezing son, and soon enough, we were on a plane bound for Queens.
Do you think your parents would have left Russia if it wasn't for your asthma?
I think the asthma played a big part in it. I think, look, it was such a tragedy for my mother because her mother was dying. And this was one of my beloved grandmothers. She also had a sister who was going to die shortly from cancer. I mean, her whole family was being decimated. And she wanted to stay behind and help them. And the only reason she could leave, her culture, her language, and of course her family, was that she had this little, tiny little, barely alive asthmatic son. And we found out very quickly that in the West they had things called steroid inhalers, which would, you know, get rid of the asthma attack. And when I was growing up, the ambulance would come almost every week to take me to the hospital because there were no other treatments for asthma. So she really made this calculation of whether to leave her family behind and have me grow up, you know, fairly healthy, or stay with them and have me grow up an invalid. And to her wonderful decision that I'm always thankful for, she decided to go to America.
Did you grow up with a sense of guilt or responsibility for having uprooted your parents?
In a sense. I mean, we realized when we got to America that, good Lord, leaving the Soviet Union was going to be great for everyone involved. I mean, it was a disaster. I remember seeing my first Chevrolet Corvette thinking, this is science fiction. Things like this aren't supposed to exist. You know, in Russia, we had these sort of nerdy science fiction films where a man in a space helmet walked around the soundstage and, you know, there were little twinkling stars behind him. But this was the 21st century right there. I fell in love with it so ridiculously and immediately that there really wasn't in my, you know, we realized that this was where we belonged. And the Soviet Union was also falling apart at that point. It was the beginning of the end, the Brezhnev years, 1979, which I guess is funny because, you know, once I settled in America, this country also began to unravel. So I am the destroyer of superpowers. Everywhere I go, things fall apart. They won't even let me land in China anymore because they're so afraid of destroying there.
Were your parents as taken with America as you were?
I think even more so. I mean, I think my father loved the idea that he was the one that really believed in Judaism to a large extent. And he wanted me to join. He joined the synagogue immediately. And that was the one community that he felt really close to, were these Orthodox Jews. I, on the other hand, was sentenced to 8 years of Hebrew school for a crime I did not commit. but it was, you know, and it was not, it was a conservative school in Queens. And to me, to him, being Jewish was this amazing thing that he had fought for all his life, and he was denied in Leningrad. But for me, it was a different experience. Those were the years when, you know, being a Russian was how you were labeled. You were labeled a Russian. It wasn't just Confederacy of Jews. It was American Jews and Israeli Jews, and then there was me and a couple of other Ruskies, and we were despised pretty roundly. You know, all those movies, Red Dawn, Red Gerbil, Red Hamster, and it was. And also I had this fur coat and a fur hat, and it smelled of various, you know, woodland animal type smells. And the teachers would take me aside and say, look, you can't be this furry. You can't dress in all these furs. Children won't play with you if you have that much fur on. And basically what I was told every day in school, that where we came from was wrong and where we were now was right. I'm not even going to dispute that, but it's a lot for a seven-year-old, for a sensitive seven-year-old boy to be told that everything he loved and believed in has to be replaced with something else.
Do you actually believed in Lenin? You wanted to join the Red Army?
Yes. I mean, I would have been killed in the Red Army within the first day of hazing. But when I was a kid, there was a huge statue of Lenin outside our apartment. And every morning, if I was allowed to leave the house, if my asthma wasn't bad enough, I would hug the pedestal of Lenin. And he just felt like a relative. He felt like just another bald, goateed relative that I had. And I wrote a little book called Lenin and His Magical Goose. I wrote it for my grandma, in which Lenin meets a magical goose and they invade Finland and create a socialist revolution. But the goose turns out to be Menshevik and Lenin is Bolshevik. So Lenin eats the goose. For political reasons. But then at the end of the book, we find out that Lenin also suffers from asthma.
You were a child when you wrote
that. I was 5 years old.
I was 5 years old. It's not clear, yeah.
Yes, I was 5 years old, and my grandmother paid me in little slices of cheese for each page. So it was 100 slices of cheese for 100 pages. Even today, Random House pays me in cheese. So the tradition continues.
And when you got to the United States, you know, in Russia you were told the United States was the enemy, and then you get here and it's kind of like, now you are the enemy. Very confusing.
Very confusing. And my father took me aside and said, look, everything you loved, the Red Army, Lenin, the Communist Party, the space program, and just went down the line. He said everything was a lie. You know, I'm 6 or 7 years old, and everything you believed in, everything you loved was a lie. And now you have to forget Lenin, and now you have to love Ronald Reagan.
Did you?
Can you do that? And I said, yes, I'll love Ronald Reagan now. And yes, I fell in love with Reagan pretty hard, the way many ex-Soviet Jewish refugees did. By age 11, I had a subscription to William F. Buckley's National Review with a picture of Margaret Thatcher on every single cover. And a few months later, I got a letter in the mail addressed to me. I was 11 years old. I opened it up. There are two rifles above an eagle, and it's the National Rifle Association has welcomed me. 11-year-old Gary Steingart is being welcomed as a full member of the NRA.
My impression is that your father kept the conservative Republican politics and you didn't.
Yes. Yes. No, my parents are. They do not watch very much Rachel Maddow or NPR for that matter. Yeah, they watch Fox News and an even scarier version of sort of these Fox News type programs on the Russian cable channel. So they spend their days, you know, watching people who get paid millions of dollars exploit the anxieties of people like themselves about the coming apocalypse and Obamacare and this and that and the other thing. So it's a little sad for me. But you know, I don't dispute that that's who they are and that those are their politics. And it's I think they're very upset that I don't share their politics, because in many ways, children in our culture are supposed to be an extension of their parents. They're supposed to believe the same things that their parents. And the fact that I turned out different, I think, is something that hurts them.
Author Gary Steingart speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview from earlier this year with novelist and satirist Gary Steingart. His memoir, called Little Failure, is now out in paperback. His family emigrated from the Soviet Union to Queens, New York, when he was 7 in 1979.
You write that you're from a family where there was a lot to worry about. You write, as you're writing about your family tree, you write, "As I march my relatives onto the pages of this book, please remember that I am also marching them toward their graves and that they will most likely meet their ends in some of the worst ways imaginable." Can you just do a brief roll call of some of the horrible ways that people in your family died in Russia?
Sure. I mean, my mother has, my mother's a wonderful cataloger of everything that has happened to our family. So thanks to her, and thanks to my father's discussions with him, I was able to do a pretty, I think, fair portrait of how my family became who they are. And that means death. You know, they died in the most horrific ways imaginable. There's an entire photo album my mother keeps, which is Uncle So-and-so, his wife and children all buried alive. You know, when the Nazis invaded Belarusia, where my grandparents were from, that entire branch of the family was just buried alive by the Germans. Then there's Uncle Aaron, who ended up in mutilated in Stalin's labor camps. Then there's my father's father, you know, who was a Red Army soldier, one of the millions who died right outside of Leningrad. He was in artillery, and Stalin had not prepared for the war. They were fighting with sticks at some point, you know, and the Germans just mowed them down. And the book includes a scene where I go to the place where my grandfather died. To me, that's one of the most important parts of the book, because my grandfather, the fact that my father wasn't raised by his actual father, but was raised by a horrific stepfather whom my grandmother remarried, who's even his best friends, his nickname among his best friends was Goebbels, you know. So when that's your nickname, you can imagine what kind of a stepfather you are. Irreparable damage to my father. Growing up with that man, the violence of that relationship. And as I wrote this book, I began to think of my own relationship with my father, which had its ups and downs, certainly more ups than his relationships with Goebbels. But I began to realize how one little trick of history, one little switch of history, could have created a very different world for both of us, especially for him, you know, because there is a loving man who is my father. But the circumstances in which he grew up, I just kept thinking, what chance did he have, you know? And it made me very sad. And it, oddly enough, in writing this book, where there are scenes of cruelty between all of us, but it made me love my parents much more, because I thought, my God, you know, where did you come from? What a place you came from with Hitler and Stalin and the lies. I mean, I can't believe you did as well as you did.
In Russia, your family was discriminated against for being Jewish, even though they weren't practicing. Then you come to the United States, and you're sent to a Hebrew school instead of a public school. And so suddenly you're put in the middle of a pretty religious environment. What sense did religion make to you at that point? And what was your understanding of Judaism, of God? That's a really big question, isn't it?
Yes.
You're welcome.
Well,
yeah.
You know, thank you. My problem was I didn't know any English, you know. So on top of not knowing English, there was another language, Hebrew, which is even harder. That they were trying to teach me, and it was too much. It was too much overload. And at home we had no television, so I couldn't learn English from TV. So for the first years in Hebrew school, I would sit apart from everyone at the cafeteria as they ate, and I would just have long conversations in Russian with myself. So here was this fruitcake wearing this gigantic fur hat and fur coat, speaking in a language nobody understood, And all the kids would run up to me and do the sort of, you know, the crazy sign and you know, and laugh and laugh and laugh. But I wouldn't stop because that was the only language that would make me comfortable. And my mother wasn't there, but in speaking it, I could pretend that the people I loved were around me. And I could pretend I would talk about all the things I'd seen before we left Russia, you know, the beauties of Yalta and all the different, we did a tour of all the places where Chekhov used to hang out. And you know, again, things that are not going to endear you to a bunch of first grade, second grade kids, especially if you're not speaking it in their language. And the prayers, the endless prayers, Baruch Atah Adonai, over and over and over again. I mean, I realized that God was bigger than all of us. There was my father who was big, and there was God who was probably even bigger. And that was the you know, the rankings in terms of parental figures. And I remember reading the we were taught very early on Abraham sacrificing Isaac. And I really thought, okay, I could sort of see my father in this role. He sent me to Hebrew school. He's gonna cut my throat because God says he should. And then God says, God is always the nice guy, and God says, hey, just kidding, you know, put that knife down, you crazy guy, Abraham. So that also reinforced this feeling that I had that life was very mercurial, that anything could happen, that there was absolutely, I was at the mercy of people higher than myself, which is, I guess, what a child can feel. But there wasn't a great feeling of safety. You know, I was in a school where I couldn't speak the language, where I walked around with my shoelaces untied, where the kids despised me, where, you know, it was a Hebrew school, but Russians were hated so much at that point that I started convincing everyone that I hadn't been born in Leningrad. I was born in East Berlin. So I was trying to convince Jewish kids that I was actually a German.
to be better liked.
To be better liked and not, you know, beaten as much. I was trying to turn myself into a Nazi rather than a commie.
So at some point you wrote your, this is perhaps your first work of satire. You wrote a satirical version of the Torah that you called the Gnora. Yeah. Because why was the title that?
Well, because the kids started calling me. There was a television show that I couldn't watch because we didn't have a TV show, but it was called.
You mean you didn't have a TV? Yeah.
We didn't have a TV, but it was called the Great Space Coaster. People of my generation may remember it. It was a show that featured a puppet antelope called Gary Gnu. And his shtick was, no gnus is good gnus. With Gary Gnus, there's no gnus guaranteed, or something like that. And he wore a turtleneck, and he was this pretentious newscaster. And I didn't know who he was because I couldn't watch him so much, but I started to appropriate his lingo. And then, so the Torah, because it was now the story of the Gnus instead of the Jews, it became the Gnora, and, you know, Exodus became Sexodus, and, you know, I was about 11 or 12, so it was already getting pretty raunchy there. There was some,
I want you to read, you reprint a little of it in your memoir, Little Failure. I want you to read a short excerpt of your Gnora.
Sure. And God spoke. Don't worry about ethics. This does not, however, mean you can act like John McEnroe. Do not pray to statues of Michael Jackson or Tom Selleck. I am your God. If you see a blind man, do not cheat him. For example, do not sell him cocaine when it is really angel dust. Don't swear in the name of Brooke Shields. By doing so, you are insulting my name. Oh, we all love Brooke Shields. Oh, my God. There was a centerfold of Brooke Shields in People magazine that the boys of Hebrew school passed around until it was more shredded than the Talmud by the time we were over through with it.
Okay. So in this Gnora that you wrote actually was a real turning point for you because it established you as a kind of a satirist in your school. People, it got passed around. It was popular. And also, it was the first time you felt really comfortable using the English language and being able to do things, to make it really work for you.
Right. It was this, you know, here I was for years trying to make sense of this hostile environment, and all of a sudden it kind of clicked, and I thought, oh, maybe I didn't put it in these terms, but what do Jews like, you know, other than not eating pork and praying quite a bit and wearing the tefillin and getting circumcised all the time? What do Jews like? And I thought, humor. This is our main thing. This is what we do better than, you know, than anyone. And satire especially. And so here we were at Hebrew school getting bombarded with Talmud and Torah and saying things that made really very little sense, reading aloud. It was all about rote memorization. And I thought, let's have some fun with this. Let's let me really get to the bottom of what this sounds like to us, you know. And I did. I had a very tenuous connection to popular culture, but I knew some things. I knew that John McEnroe was acting out. I knew that Brooke Shields was the most beautiful woman that ever lived. And in fact, I think we were a lot of debates about whether she was Jewish or not, you know, whether she was Brooke Shieldowitz. That was sort of our big dream, was that she could be part of our tribe. If she was a part of our tribe, then we really wouldn't win. We wouldn't need all those Nobel Prize winners. We could just have Brooke Shields. So all those different things. And then also making fun of some of the kids in school that weren't so nice to me. And, you know, it was written on an actual scroll, which I typed sideways so that it looked like a real Torah. And I put the two, I can't remember what they're called, the two sort of sticks that hold the Torah that, with which you can unroll the scroll. So it was a really professional job. And I would pass it around. And kids who never, you know, what happened was that the kids who just thought, oh, here's that Russian kid. All of a sudden, I wasn't just that Russian kid. I was, you know, that crazy kid who wrote the Gonorrah.
Did you get in trouble for it in school?
No, I mean, I don't think the rabbis were especially happy, but I think they also were, they were on a different planet. They were not able, I think, to comprehend the full, you know, absurdity of the Gonorrah. So I don't think I got into, I would get in trouble all the time for speaking out in class and singing in class and singing songs in class. And I would be sent to the principal's office quite a bit. I was always acting out, you know, but I think the Gonorrah, the censors didn't get the Gonorrah.
Novelist and satirist Gary Steingart speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. His memoir, called Little Failure, is now out in paperback. We'll continue their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where nutritional therapy is an integral part of every patient's treatment plan. More at cancercenter.com. From ITVS, with the Independent Lens season premiere film, Bully, investigating the cruelty kids endure at the hands of other kids, Monday at 10 Eastern on PBS. And from eSurance, insurance for the modern world, with online tools that provide customers with 24/7 advice and support. Learn more at eSurance.com. This is NPR.
Showtime's new series, The Affair, beginning Sunday, could be one of the best new shows of the year. Coming up, I'll have a review. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new movie Whiplash, which won a grand jury prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. And we continue Terry's conversation with author Gary Steingart. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's interview from earlier this year with Gary Steingart. After writing satirical novels like The Russian Debutante's Handbook, Absurdistan, and Super Sad True Love Story, he's written a memoir called Little Failure. It's now out in paperback. Steingart was a sickly, asthmatic boy of seven when he and his parents emigrated from the Soviet Union to Queens, New York in 1979. After Jews were allowed to leave.
Because you couldn't practiced, your parents couldn't practice Judaism in the Soviet Union when they lived there. When you got to the United States, your family wanted you to be circumcised and brought into the, you know, the Jewish tribe. How old were you when you were circumcised?
I think it was around 8 or 9, maybe 8. I'm a little fuzzy on the details since I've been trying to repress them for so long.
But yeah. You uncorked those memories for your memoir, and it's both a really painful but also really funny chapter. I want you to read just a little bit of that. And I should mention, because this will be referred to in the reading, there's a reference to Emmanuel, which was a series of softcore porn movies that your father mistakenly took you to.
It was called Emmanuel, the Love of a Woman, I believe, or Emmanuel, the Wants of a Woman. And it was, I don't know if it was softcore, I think it was mediumcore porn. And my father was a big aficionado of French culture, and he thought this would be a wonderful way to get his son involved with, you know, Balzac and Voltaire. And so... You know, and then we went in there, and there was a theater on Main Street in Flushing, and it was one vagina after another. And he just put his hand around my eyes, and I kept trying to pry his hand off because I desperately wanted to see what was on the screen. And I did see, I counted about 7 genitals that I saw, which was 7 more than I would see for a very long time.
So, because there's a reference to that, now everyone will know what you're referring to. So if you could read a brief section of your chapter about being circumcised at the age of, did you say you were 8?
I think 8. I could be wrong on that. I'll have to ask my mohel, my circumciser. Okay. The next year, I get the present every boy wants. A circumcision. At Solomon Schechter School of Queens, I have been given an appropriately sacrificial Hebrew name, Yitzchak, or Isaac. And so the knife is drawn at Coney Island Hospital, Orthodox men davening out a blessing in the adjoining room, a sedation mask placed over my mouth, perfect for an asthmatic boy with an anxiety disorder. And then the public hospital walls, green on green on green on green, disappear to be replaced by a dream where the horrible things lovingly perpetrated upon Emmanuel in a Hong Kong brothel are done to me by the men in black hats. And then the pain. Mama, Papa, where are you? And then the layers of pain. Mama, Papa, help! And then the layers of pain and humiliation.
Okay, and it goes on in the book. That sounds like a really horrible chapter of your life that lasted, the pain and humiliation lasted a lot longer than you would have liked.
Yes. Don't try this at home.
Yeah. In retrospect, do you think your parents did the right thing in having you circumcised at the age of 8-ish?
My father's belief was that without this, I would not be fully a Jewish boy. And in his mind, there was nothing more important than making sure that I was a Jewish boy. I think my mother probably had her doubts. I'm pretty sure she did because she's very against these kind of medical interventions. But I think for him, it meant the world to him. It was awful for me, but some kind of bond did survive, you know. I did become what he always wanted to be, which was a person growing up in a country where being Jewish wasn't a mark against you. In some parts of New York, it was a mark for you, you know. And I'm not super happy that it happened, but I've certainly made peace with my mohel.
There was a lot of conflict in your relationship with your father, and you found a kind of father figure when you were in college in a man who was, you know, not sure how old he was, but he was older than you, old enough to be a father figure. And he was making a documentary about, you know, college life, college kids, and you were a part of that. And you became very close. He was a writer for soap operas, so he was like the accomplished writer in your life.
Right.
And he would give you advice. But then you started to take advantage of him. I mean, it sounded like at that point in your life that you were just kind of mean-spirited.
I was very mean-spirited. I was full of anger that I didn't know why. I didn't know who to project it towards. I had my very first relationship with a very loving woman from North Carolina, my first girlfriend from college, and the relationship was breaking up. Not her fault, not my fault. It was just ending. And I felt incredibly hurt by the fact that I couldn't sustain a relationship. I was angry at my parents who kept trying to shunt me into law school, and I so desperately wanted to be a writer at that point, and I had finished the first and second draft of my very first book, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, but I was too scared to send it out. I was drinking prodigiously and angry at and scared by my parents. And so the only person that I could take it all out on was the person who was giving me the most love and guidance of anyone I knew, and this was my friend John. He would go over draft after draft of my novel, and each time he would do that, I would get angry at his criticisms, and I would say, what do you know? You're just a soap opera writer. I'm a real literary fiction writer. You're nothing, you know. And he just, you know, he put up with it for years until finally he didn't. You know, I mean, I guess one thing I should say about this memoir that I hope comes across is that I never want to glorify who I was. Long periods of my life, I wasn't a great person. Maybe I'm still not, but there was a lot of the hurt that was my inheritance became the inheritance of other people, especially other people who wanted to help me. And John was probably the prime example of that.
You reprint a letter that he sent you almost as an intervention. You know, he was really trying to straighten you out. And I'd like you to read an excerpt of that letter.
Sure. You are not a child, and I am not your parent. There is practically nothing writerly about your process. Your acute and omnipresent anxiety causes you to function much more as an accountant or a producer with his eyes on the bottom line and no understanding of how artists function, rather than as a young writer trying to develop a first novel, a new career. In short, you are as mean and ungenerous to yourself as your parents are. They taught you well. You are no longer 20 as you were when we met. You are pushing 30. The wounded child, in a defensive rage, has become an adult man, hurting himself and inflicting pain on others. Your inability to empathize makes it difficult for you to put yourself in the skin of the characters you write. You have to decide to take yourself seriously, not in a phony, self-pitying way, but in a serious, dignified way.
And the letter goes on. What was your reaction when you got that letter?
I was... Of course, furious. What, you rich American, what do you know of what my childhood was like? What do you know what it's like to be me? Just go and write your soap operas.
What hit hardest from this letter once you were able to actually stop being so defensive and digest some of it?
That I was inflicting pain on others. That I was capable of doing... I mean, I didn't have the sort of global view that I have now, that things begin sort of with my father's father dying in the fields outside of Leningrad, and then his horrifying stepfather takes over, and then all of that rolls downhill and ends up, you know, partly the relationship I had with him. But then whoever loves me will get a piece of that action, will get a piece of that hurt. You know, I mean, one of the reasons I think I started writing this memoir is because I realized that we were going to have a child. And I wanted to know as much as I could about what my life was like so that hopefully none of that history, the weight of history that we carry on our shoulders, that the most minimal amount of that would end up on his shoulders.
So your friend John loans you some money, some more money, because he's already loaned you a lot, and insists that you use some of it for psychotherapy. And you do. You go into analysis. When you went into therapy... Yeah. Your father's reaction was, it would have been better if you had told me you were a homosexual.
yes.
Which I guess is...
I love that line. In
whatever,
fact,
right?
I love all of my parents' lines because they're so... I mean, what luck it is to have parents who say things like that. You know, it's the editing is so minimal, it goes straight from their mouth and into the book. Yes, that's the fear. And I guess because, you know, when a son says, I'm gay... Well, you can fight with that, and you can say, you know, you're a disgrace, and try to show the light of the wonders of heterosexuality, and you're destroying me and your mom, and et cetera, et cetera. But when a child goes into psychoanalysis, you really are losing him, because the child is now developing the skills in which to reevaluate the relationship with you, and that's much more dangerous.
How old are you now?
41.
And so you just became a parent. Your child is 3 months old. Did it take you a long time before you felt like you wanted to or were capable of being a parent?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what it was. And I think this is the confluence of three sort of things happening. One, well, the baby, and the second being the publication of this memoir, which puts me, I think, in a better place to be a parent. And the third is that psychoanalysis is finally coming to an end, you know, free at last, only 12 years, four times a week. So I don't think I overdid it, but, you know, it's time to walk out into the sunlight. So all these different things happen together, and I'm very happy. I'm actually as happy as I've ever been.
So your book kind of opens with a panic attack. Do you still get them?
Yeah, I carry enough Ativan to, you know, tranquilize a moose. It's very interesting. My mother talked about how her fear growing up was a fear of being buried alive, which made a lot of sense since a huge part of her family was buried alive by the Germans. And lately, I've begun to experience a fear of being in enclosed spaces, like airplanes and trains and places where I can't readily escape from, you know. So it's very interesting how all these genetically and, I guess, conditionally. But no, I didn't know that so many of my relatives were buried alive until recently. But the panic attacks about enclosed spaces had begun before that. The mind is a fascinating and an absolutely horrifying thing. It does these things to you that you don't even know where they come from, but they come from somewhere.
Well, Gary Steingart, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It was great.
Novelist and satirist Gary Steingart speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. His memoir, Little Failure, is now out in paperback. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Whiplash, the new movie starring J.K. Simmons from Oz and Law and Order. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The second feature by the 29-year-old director Damien Chazelle is called Whiplash and centers on the agony of a drummer in a high-powered music school. The movie stars the young film actor Miles Teller from the spectacular Now and J.K. Simmons, who is best known for his TV roles on Law & Order and Oz. Whiplash won a grand prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Whiplash charts the education and torture of ambitious young drummer Andrew Neiman, played by Miles Teller. The inflictor of pain is a teacher, Terence Fletcher, played by J.K. Simmons. Fletcher conducts the elite jazz band at the Manhattan Conservatory, where Andrew is a student. Film has a long dishonor role of sadistic authority figures, but few of them get as much of a charge as Fletcher out of messing with pupils' heads, even driving them from the school in tears. Writer-director Damien Chazelle has you wondering two things at once. Will Andrew succeed in wowing this most exacting of judges? And, more important, what can be gained by doing so when the teacher is manifestly psychotic? There's also a larger question. Does the director finally vindicate Fletcher's methods, suggesting that only a harsh taskmaster can spur an artist like Andrew to the next level? Before I try to answer, let me say I love this movie. The title is dead on. Whiplash twists you into knots. The fear of failure is omnipresent, but so, somehow, is the jazz vibe. When Andrew snatches up his sticks and the band launches into a standard, say Hank Levy's Whiplash, it's hard not to smile and sway and tap your foot. Miles Teller does all the characters playing, so Chazelle doesn't have to hide his hands. Except for an occasional grimace, Teller's face is rapt. He's playing. He's not acting playing. He tells everyone he wants to be one of the greats. Long into the night, he thumps on his drums, blisters opening, blood smudging his sticks. When it's time to rehearse the band, Simmons Fletcher materializes in the class doorway like a vampire. There's no fat on the actor. He's all sinew and teeth and bald dome. In one scene, outside class, he's warmly attentive to Andrew. He says, just relax, have fun. Then Andrew sits down to play.
5, 6, 7. Not quite my tempo. It's all good. No worries. Here we go. 5, 6, 7. You're rushing. Here we go. Ready? Okay. 5, 6, and. Dragging just a hair. Wait for my cue. 5, 6, 7. Rushing. 5, 6, and. Dragging. 'Cause I just hurled a chair at your head, Neiman.
I don't know.
Sure you do.
The tempo?
Were you rushing or were you dragging?
I don't know.
Start counting.
5, 6, 7.
In 4, damn it! Look at me!
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Now, was I rushing or was I dragging?
I don't know.
Count again.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Rushing or dragging?
Rushing.
So you do know the difference!
Hearing Fletcher slap Andrew across the face, I'm having traumatic flashbacks. What about that question Whiplash poses? Does Andrew, on some level, need a bad authority figure? His dad, played by Paul Reiser, is a mild presence who loves Andrew unconditionally, which is what we want from a parent, right? But Fletcher thinks to be great, you need abuse. He tells his class about the teenage Charlie Parker, who fled a jam after drummer Joe Jones threw a cymbal at him. Parker vowed to come back better, and did. I don't think director Chazelle has a tidy answer. When you listen to stories of great artists or athletes, you often hear how terribly their parents and coaches drove them, and how that paid off. You also hear about people being destroyed, psychologically and physically. I know a woman whose gorgeous soprano was ruined by an abusive teacher. A good dramatist doesn't need to reconcile the two sides, only bring them both to life. I do know Chazelle believes great art should cost the artist. At the end of his debut feature, the 2009 Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench, the protagonist is on the verge of losing his lover and plays a long, increasingly desperate and discordant trumpet solo. He's pushing against the limits of his talent, maybe of his soul. Chazelle's heroes are artist existentialists. They create themselves anew every day. They beat the drums until they bleed.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Coming up, I review the new Showtime drama series, The Affair, which starts Sunday. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Biancooley. The broadcast networks continue to roll out their new fall series. The CW network premiered The Flash this week and unveils another surprisingly entertaining series, Jane the Virgin, on Monday. But cable networks, which used to take a breather as the broadcasters strutted their fall stuff, now compete as strongly as at any other time. This week, FX presented Freak Show, the latest and strongest incarnation of its American Horror Story anthology franchise. And this Sunday, Showtime launches a drama that ultimately could emerge as the very best new TV series of 2014. Showtime's newest drama series, The Affair, is the story of two people who betray their respective spouses and fall into an extramarital relationship. What makes this TV show so distinctively different and so utterly captivating is that it's not told from just one point of view. It's like Akira Kurosawa's classic Japanese drama Rashomon, or Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, where memories are revisited that turn out to be less than entirely accurate or trustworthy. It means you have to pay close attention. But if you do, the subtleties and subtexts build up and offer entirely new possible interpretations of events. To make this work on TV, you have to start with charismatic actors, people good enough at their craft and so likable as performers that you forgive them their trespasses even as you see them stray down a troublesome path. Showtime's The Affair nails that element of the equation, as it does every other part, 100%. The part of Noah Soloway, the New York public school teacher and first-time author with a wife and four kids, is played by Dominic West, who shot to stardom as McNulty on HBO's The Wire. The part of Allison Lockhart, a Long Island waitress with a husband and a shared recent tragedy, is played by Ruth Wilson, who impressed me tremendously as the unhinged stalker on the original season of the BBC America import, Luther. And their respective spouses are no slouches either. Maura Tierney from ER plays Noah's wife, and Joshua Jackson from Fringe plays Allison's husband. The Affair is structured as one long series of flashbacks, not intertwined, but presented in turn. So in Sunday's premiere episode, for example, we see how Noah and Allison met, first from his perspective in the show's first half hour, then in hers. Each portion reveals details and background missing from the other. But even when they cover the same ground, the details are different, down to who makes the first move, even the first joke. Some facts are uncontested. Noah and his family go on summer vacation at his father-in-law's estate in eastern Long Island. In town, Allison, the waitress, serves them breakfast. And late that night, when Noah breaks away to take a solo stroll on the beach, he encounters Allison, who's sitting there all alone, away from a bonfire party farther down the beach. Here's how that encounter began, according to him.
Allison? Hi.
You found me.
No, I was just out on a walk.
I'm kidding, it's a tiny town.
Right, sorry.
And later, when that same scene is recounted in the second half of the show, from Allison's point of view, it starts like this.
Hello.
Oh, hi.
I found you.
Were you looking for me?
Well, I'm kidding.
Oh.
I was just on my way to check out that bonfire over there.
Oh, wow.
You coming from there, or are you... Too bad I could have used an introduction.
This isn't the first time TV has tried a he-says-she-says approach to marriage and marital infidelity. The first was in a pair of 1973 ABC made-for-TV movies called Divorce His and Divorce Hers. That starred Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. But The Affair is much less shrill, much more polished, and much more challenging. The closer you listen and the more you observe, the more fascinating Showtime's The Affair becomes. Watching the opening episode, I was especially knocked out by the attention to tiny details, like how the trendy sunglasses worn by Noah's coming-of-age teenage daughter in his recollection turned into heart-shaped Lolita sunglasses in Allison's memory of her. Who's telling the truth here? And why do such inconsistencies matter, if they do at all? The Affair is created by Sarah Treem and Haggai Levy, who last worked on another superb examination of memory and credibility, HBO's riveting series about psychotherapy called In Treatment. The other executive producers are just as commendable. Eric Overmyer was a writer-producer on Homicide: Life on the Street, The Wire, and Tremé, and Jeffrey Reiner was a producer and director on Friday Night Lights. Like the actors, they've all done excellent work here to tell these stories. But which character's story is the more believable? Whose memory and whose point of view proves more trustworthy? Ultimately, that's for us viewers to decide. And my decision already is that The Affair is a new show I believe has to be added to my weekly must-watch list. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Schrock is our senior producer. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. John Sheehan directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from ITVS with the Independent Lens season premiere film, Bully, investigating the cruelty kids endure at the hands of other kids, Monday at 10 Eastern on PBS. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children at aecf.org. And from The Honest Company, providing natural, eco-friendly products for the family and home. Learn more at honest.com. This is NPR.
Broadway has never been broader. It's not just for gays anymore.
Neil Patrick Harris has won two Emmys for hosting the Tonys and won a Tony this year for playing the title role in Hedwig and the Angry Inch. On the next Fresh Air, Neil Patrick Harris tells us about performing on Broadway, surviving child stardom, and his new memoir. Join us. It's not just for gays anymore.